It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day. Iowa is wet. We all know that. And the moisture has given us a lot of opportunities to interact with insects lately. But for the time being, we're not going to talk about those clouds of insects we fight with every time we go outdoors. We're going to talk about aquatic insects right now. Of course, we'll get to plants a little bit later on. But with me right now is Donald Lewis, professor of entomology at Iowa State University. Hello, Donald.
Hello, Charity, and happy solstice to you.
Well, happy solstice to you. And I'm sure that we are going to get phone calls about gnats and mosquitoes, but let's ignore them for the time being.
I just wish we could.
I know, I try. But let's talk about some aquatic insects, and we're going to talk about some pretty cool insects. I think we should start with the least popular on the list that you sent me, which I think are the mayflies. They don't bite us, but people aren't always thrilled to see them. Tell me a little bit about mayflies.
Well, we have dozens of species of mayflies, so it's not all one kind. And as you look at the length of the Mississippi River and all of its tributaries, there are different species that come out at different times. But mayflies live in the river. They live at the mud at the bottom of the river for anywhere from 1 to 3 years. And then often mass numbers of them, like tens of millions, will emerge at the same time, and they will swarm around the river. It would be okay if they would stay at the water, but what happens is they are attracted to lights along the river, and so they're brought into town, they're attracted to streetlights, they're attracted to the lights on the bridges over the rivers, and because there are so many of them, they do become a nuisance, they can actually become a hazard, they can become a mess. But mayfly is a well-known insect if you live along a river.
And I remember it was about 5 years ago where there was a particularly big emergence of mayflies, and we were seeing it on radars. It looked like thunderstorms over the river, but instead it was mayflies, right?
It's a cloud of insects that are rising up. Mayflies have four wings, and as they're beating their wings to stay in the air, they reflect the radar that we use for detecting storm clouds, and they do show up occasionally as these swarms. Just like recently, there were swarms of ladybugs in California that were flying high enough in the air to be detected on radar. So, yes, we know these insects are out there from walking along the river, living along the river, but even people far away can detect that they're there.
What do they eat?
In the adult stage, they don't. In addition to these vast numbers of mayflies, adults that merge at one time, they have a very short life cycle. They have a very short lifespan. They were 3 years in the river as larvae, but when they emerge in the adult stage, they may only live for 12 hours. That's why by sunup, you find piles of dead mayflies under the streetlights, under the porch lights, under the lights on the bridges, and so forth. And in that 12 hours, they have a higher priority than eating, and that is sex, so they can reproduce. And in that 12 hours, they will mate, they'll lay eggs, and they'll die. And so it's an interesting style of life, but it gave them an interesting name. The name of the mayfly group is Ephemeroptera, which sounds like ephemeral, which is exactly what they are.
So they're here, and then they're gone.
Individually.
All right.
But the mass population can extend over a few days, it can extend for a week. And of course, we get different species. Some mayflies emerge in May, as the name would imply. Other mayflies don't emerge until July and bother those who are watching fireworks along the river for the 4th of July.
Well, it sounds like that larval stage is surprisingly long.
It can be, depending on the species. And during that time, they are feeding on debris in the water. They are helping clean the water of algae and other floating debris and so forth. And in that process, they are also valuable as fish food, that they are an important link in the aquatic food chain of going from plants and debris to small animal life to mayfly animal life up to fish. So they are important that way, and we enjoy seeing them. Some of us enjoy seeing them, because we know of the ecological role that they have played.
And when they emerge as mayflies, how large are they?
varies with the species, but we're talking about something that can be as small as half an inch, and some of them a body length of maybe an inch to an inch and a quarter. So they're not huge insects. They're not as big as butterflies. And then their wings will be another inch in length. So when they stop with their wings out, you may notice, oh, they're about 2 inches wide. So medium-sized insects with fairly fragile-looking bodies. They're not stout and robust like beetles. They're just kind of fragile and skinny-looking little things that have come up to have their moment above the water to lay eggs and start the next generation.
I can imagine that when they emerge, that also sparks a feeding frenzy, not just among fish, but among many other creatures. Do we see swallows and bats eating them?
Bats certainly would, and raccoons will come out and feed on the piles that are accumulating under the streetlights. So, yes, the adults are a link in the food chain as well. But they emerge at night, which limits a little bit who's going to get to take advantage of them, but bats certainly would. Now, mayflies are also, in the adult stage, still fish food. And as they land on the water or as they skim across the top of the water to lay their eggs, fish will come up and gobble them. And that's why mayfly is a common lure that fly fishermen use when they're trying to catch trout and other insects or other fish.
Let's talk about some of the insects that I think people get a little more excited about seeing than mayflies. Let's talk about dragonflies and damselflies. I think there's something that we have a lot of romance about. They're charismatic insects.
Charismatic and a little bit of myth about them. Those dragonflies that have wingspans of, oh, maybe 3 to 4 inches and a body length of almost 3 inches are sometimes considered dangerous. Like, oh, that's going to sting me. Of course, they can't sting. They don't have a stinger like wasps and bees. And then they get names like Devil's Darning Needle, which certainly doesn't help your reputation at all as a harmless, beneficial insect. But again, dragonflies and damselflies live underwater for a period of a year or more, during which time they feed on other insects and small fish. So they are predators in the water. And then in the adult stage, they become predators of flying insects. And one of the observations that happens occasionally is you'll see a swarm of dragonflies zigzagging back and forth through the air. What they're doing is they are sweeping mosquitoes and gnats and other small insects out of the air in their front legs that are held like a basket and gobbling them up as fast as they can. So dragonflies and damselflies are beneficial again.
Are they, I think we've talked about this before, somewhat ancient creatures?
Yes, there were dragonflies before the dinosaurs, which we can't say about the moths and butterflies. We can say that about the cockroaches. So, yes, dragonflies are one of those ancient groups that were around a long time ago, and whatever caused the mass extinctions of the past, the dragonflies have been able to survive, and they are still here.
How long do they live once they emerge as insects?
You know, in the adult stage, they probably live a month at most, but during that time, they're going to do a lot of feeding on mosquitoes and other small insects that are flying in the air. They also eat ant swarmers that are in the air. But during that time, again, they're going to mate so that the female can lay eggs back on the water. Those eggs sink to the bottom, hatch into a nymph, also called a naiad, that is going to live and grow in the mud at the bottom of the river.
They emerge from the water, and of course we see them near the water a lot, but we also see them away from the water.
They get up and they fly quite long distances. I think they're also carried in the wind, but they're very fast flyers. One of the frustrations of trying to make an insect collection is you want a nice, perfectly spread dragonfly in your insect collection, and you go out with your net and you try to catch them, and they're very agile. They're very good at flying up, down, sideways, backwards, forwards, and with eyes that give them almost a 360-degree view of the world, they can see your net coming long before it gets to them, and they'll just dodge out of the way. So dragonflies are hard to catch because they are such good flyers, and I think that gets them long distances from water. Now, eventually, they have to get back to reproduce,
right.
But enough of them must make it.
I was going to ask about that because at my house, occasionally we'll see swarms of dragonflies, and the closest pool of water is at least a mile away from our house, the closest pond. I mean, there are some almost dry creeks, but it does seem like they really travel long distances.
I think they get up and get around, and that's the same can be said with some other insects that are flying. We see butterflies able to scatter themselves across the entire state of Iowa from a few migrant monarch butterflies that arrived here last month. So insects are good at getting around to find the food they need, but eventually they have the ability to get back to the spot where they need to reproduce.
What's the difference between a dragonfly and a damselfly?
The easy one is the size. Damselflies are very small. They look very delicate. The largest damselfly is only going to be about 1.25 inches in length, where the largest dragonfly is going to be more like 3 inches. If they stop flying, the difference that is obvious is when dragonflies perch, they hold their wings down flat, out to the side. When damselflies perch, they hold their wings upright together. So the position of the wings is probably the easiest way to tell them, in addition to just the difference in size.
And we've talked about what they eat. Who eats them?
Anybody who can catch them, which isn't going to be very many. There may be some clever birds that can get to them. There are pictures online of dragonflies that have been caught by a praying mantis. So other predators who have to eat will try, and they are another link in the food in the food chains of the ecosystem. And I think they're not as good a food source for a lot of things as some other insects, but birds and other insect eaters will at least try to get one.
And if you aren't a fan of mosquitoes and gnats and flying ants, then dragonflies and damselflies are really good news when you see them, right?
They are your friend. Remember, dragonflies are harmless and they are beneficial.
All right, we are going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment, and we will talk more about insects, and we'll also talk about plants, of course, because it's Horticulture Day. With me right now, entomologist Donald Lewis from Iowa State University. Richard Giron, Iowa State University Extension Horticulture Specialist, is going to join us in just a moment, and you can join us too. Call 866-780-9100, 866-780-9100, or email talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Iowa's rivers and streams are swollen with water right now. They're also teeming with insect life. Today, we'll find out about the insects living in those waters. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day. Iowa State University entomologist Donald Lewis will be here. Iowans have been encountering a lot of insects lately. This hour, we'll talk about aquatic insects, some we love to see and some we don't enjoy so much. Damselflies, dragonflies, mayflies, and more. Iowa State University Extension Horticulture Specialist Richard Giron will also be here, and he and Donald will answer your questions about plants and insects. Join the conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today, and you are welcome to join the conversation with your questions about plants or insects. Give us a call. 866-780-9100 is the number. 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at Iowa Public Radio. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. With me, Donald Lewis, professor of entomology at Iowa State University, and Richard Giron, Iowa State University Extension Horticulture Specialist. Hello, Richard.
Good morning.
And Donald, I know you've been getting calls from all over the state, but over here in eastern Iowa, we are complaining nonstop about gnats. What are you hearing from people? Are there infestations in different places?
I'm hearing a lot from eastern Iowa and less so about gnats from the other side, more there than from the other parts of the state. But the word gnat is a mile wide, and it means could mean thousands of different things. But generally, what we're talking about is called the fungus gnat. If it is a gnat, if a fungus gnat has the body like a mosquito, they buzz around lights. There's they occupy these swarms in the air. And they all come from damp locations, and that includes most of Iowa soils right now. So we can raise fungus gnats in the potted plants inside the house. We can get a few of them that way. But when the whole countryside is damp soil, we can get lots and lots of these fungus gnats. But mixed with that is another group of insects called the midges, which are usually along lakes and streams and ponds, and they're the ones that just sort of stay in a swarm in the air. The fungus gnats frequently are not in huge masses all at one time, so both midges and fungus gnats are doing very well because of the weather so far this spring.
All right, and I think we're also seeing some black flies or buffalo gnats.
Buffalo gnat was a little bit earlier for most of the state based on our observations, but there could be a lingering few.
Or maybe we're just not over it yet.
Yeah, you're still complaining about the bites on the back of your neck.
Exactly.
The problem. But of those three, midges, fungus gnats, and black flies, the black fly is the only one that actually bites. So that's the one that is the pest that buzzes around your head, bites you on your ears, bites you on the back of the neck.
All right. And Richard, you were mentioning that you're seeing plenty of mosquitoes in central Iowa.
We were in the Ames area for maybe 2 or 3 weeks. They were just enormous numbers, but that population has basically just fallen dramatically in recent days, which is good.
Yeah. Maybe it's safe to go outside.
Yes.
without spraying yourself. Oh, do you have
you might still want to use repellent. My experience in my backyard is, like Richard said, 2 weeks ago, they were just swarms around your face and all the exposed skin. And now, there's one or two there. So they're still there. They're just not there in the abundance. And we have seen this statewide in the mosquito surveillance program, that mosquitoes peaked a couple of weeks ago and have fallen off to almost zero in the trapping program around the state.
All right. Well, that's nice to hear. How about ticks? I've certainly seen a lot of those.
Well, they have their season, and mostly their season is a little earlier in the year. But with the abundant moisture, ticks may continue to look for small animals to feed upon. And when they can't find enough chipmunks and raccoons and squirrels, then yes, if you walk through their area, they will reach out, grab hold of your leg, and climb up to feed on you as well. We're probably past the peak of tick season, but if you've been out in an area where ticks are likely, it's still advisable to do a tick check when you get back in and make sure you don't have one attached to you.
All right. 866-780-9100 is the number to call with your questions. You can email talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And here is an email question from Eric. He says, I found a linden tree sapling in my grove. I transplanted it, but when digging it up, I broke the tap root. It did still have several clumps of lateral roots. It's only about 12 to 18 inches tall. If it lives, will it regrow the tap root? Could it possibly grow but be unstable when it's large and potentially dangerous?
It actually doesn't need that tap root for the most part. Most tree roots are actually quite shallow. Most are found in the upper 18 inches of soil. They tend to be very, very long, horizontal, but not very deep. And so that should be fine if it survives.
All right. That's good news for you, Eric. Thanks a lot for the question. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. We'll do a couple more email questions here. This one's from Kevin. For you, Donald, he says, we have small ants that reappear at the same spot in our kitchen every spring, above the kitchen sink and below the window. We eventually knock them back, but why the same spot every year? And if we had a window into the wall, what would we see?
If we could see into that ant nest, there's probably not much there. These small ants are probably the odorous house ant. It's a very problematic species that nests outside in the soil. It also nests in cavities in the walls and so forth. But odorous house ant doesn't make much of a structure. They just sort of take the existing cavity and whatever the hollow space is, they have a queen and some larvae and some pupae, and the workers are going out to gather up food. These small ants make very small colonies, the colonies don't take up a lot of space, so there probably is not much to see. My guess is there may have been a little dampness in that area, there's less insulation, or there's some cavity right in that area where they're able to nest. And then, of course, the sink provides moisture, maybe a little food material for them. It's a great place to live if you're an ant, where both house and food are right in the same place.
All right. And Kevin has a question for you, too, Richard. He says, I found a very interesting spiky plant at a garden center last night called Beaujolais lysimachia. Forgive me if I messed that up, but the tag said it may be invasive. Are you familiar with this plant, and how bad is it?
Well, lysimachia, some of those can be quite aggressive. There is one called gooseneck loosestrife. It is very aggressive. It spreads very quickly. It's not really invasive, but it's very aggressive. And if you were to plant that, I would plan on digging and dividing it every 2 or 3 years to contain it because it is so very, very aggressive. There's also a ground cover type that definitely is very aggressive too. It just hugs the ground. There's a variety that has yellow leaves. Kind of uses a ground cover, but that can be very aggressive too. And I would classify that more maybe invasive.
All right. Would you steer clear?
I would. The second one, yes.
Okay. And you can email your questions, talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Let's go to the phone. Steve is on the line in Urbandale. Hi, Steve.
Hi there. Hey, I planted a couple of perennials in a big pot, and salvia being one of them, and it got beat down by the rain.
Okay.
It's all laying over and everything. I wondered, it's kind of tall. Can I cut those spikes off, and will they regrow new ones?
Have they already bloomed? I would assume they have.
Well, yeah, they don't bloom real well for some reason, but
okay.
Yeah.
Typically, you can cut them back after they're done blooming, and they'll come back and bloom again. So you can cut them back. They should come back, and hopefully will bloom later on this summer.
Great. I've got another one. I forget the name, darn it. It's a real light blue with kind of small flowers on it. Jeez.
Light blue, small flowers.
It was blooming when I got it at the nursery, and it's still blooming. After a month or so, you know.
Okay.
And did it get flattened by the rain too?
Oh, delphinium.
Delphinium is what it is.
Okay.
Delphinium.
So that's a tall plant. As soon as that's done blooming, cut it back, and it may bloom again in late summer.
All right. I'll try that.
All right. Thanks a lot for your call, Steve.
Thank you. Uh-huh.
Yep. 866-780-9100 is the number for you to call. We've got a few lines open for you right now. And Richard, I can imagine you've been getting a lot of calls from people saying that their plants have been pummeled by rain. I mean, we've got a lot of things laying over flat, don't we?
A few things. I guess the main thing, though, is because of the very wet spring weather, we're seeing more things like anthracnose on sycamores, where the sycamores are barely leafed out right now. And that's because the initial leaves contacted anthracnose and they dried up and basically they didn't do anything. But they're trying to leaf out again. They're looking better, but they're still fairly sparse, but they should be fine. We're seeing apple scab on crab apples, cedar apple rust on crab apples. So when you have very wet conditions, you tend to have very favorable conditions for some of the foliar leaf spots on trees and shrubs.
All right, let's go back to the phones. 866-780-9100. Jim is on the line in Iowa City. Hi, Jim.
Hello, how are you doing today?
Good.
I have a question about dragonflies. I have some ponds in my yard, man, you know, I dug them out, and they're, you know, the biggest is like 30 by 50, but I get tons of different species of dragonflies and damselflies. I notice them, they'll cling on to the side of like a rush or a cattail blade, and then crawl down into the water with their tail downward, and it's like they're cutting a hole into the shaft of the plant with their tail. Do they lay their eggs there, or what are they doing?
There's a couple of different things that could be happening here. One is dragonflies have a funny intermediate stage that they'll come up out of the water, and the nymph will cling to a stem, usually above the waterline, and that will split open, and the dragonfly will emerge as sort of a pre-adult, and then it will later finish that process and be the adult stage. But yes, the females go back to the water to lay eggs, depending on species. Some of them skim across the top of the water and they just drop eggs as they're flying. Others dip their abdomen into the water so that the eggs are sort of washed off the tail end of the insect. And others do actually place their eggs underwater. Now, I don't know that they can actually burrow into the stem. That I'm going to have to think about that one and look that one up. But standing on an emerged plant with their tail in the water could be their egg-laying behavior. So I think you've done some great observations there.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, because I just sit there, I'm just amazed by them, and my wife and daughter are, you know, avid photographers, and they've got a lot of good shots of them. But, you know, I just saw them doing it quite a bit, like the swamp gardeners, and I think they're four spots, or I don't know what, you know. My wife knows all the different species of them.
Yeah. So. You know, if you're really interested in them, there's a great volunteer science website in Iowa called Iowa Odes. Iowa and then O-D-E-S. And that's the slang term for dragonflies and damselflies because the family name is, the name of that group is Odonata. And so people who are hip to dragonflies shorten the name to just Odes, O-D-E-S. So iowaodes.org is a great website for identifying dragonflies and learning more about them. So a great website created by a group of volunteers here in the state.
Oh, thank you very much. Yeah, we're my wife, myself, and my daughter, we're all master naturalists with the University of Illinois. I live outside Chicago, but I drive through Iowa every day. I'm a road driver for UPS.
So, oh, okay.
You know, I always try to catch this program every week. So,
well, thanks a lot, Jim.
Great. Yes. All right. Thank you very much. Yeah. And y'all have a good weekend.
Thank you. You too. Drive safe out there. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can join our conversation with your questions and, of course, about insects or plants. Let's go to John on the line in Knoxville. Hi, John.
Hello.
Hi. What's your question?
Well, it's for Don Lewis. What's the purpose of black flies biting mammals?
Well, black flies are like mosquitoes. The blood that they feed on is the protein that the females are going to use to manufacture eggs. And it's only the females of both of those species that bite. And so when mosquitoes are biting us, it's the female who's taking enough protein food source so she can manufacture eggs. And that's the same with black flies. That the food is going to be remanufactured, not to make another insect, but to make eggs that female will lay.
Where do they lay them?
In the case of black flies, the eggs are laid in running water, not in still water, not in impoundments the way the mosquitoes are, but black flies lay their eggs in rivers and streams, which is why we can't go back and treat the source. We can't put enough insecticide in all the rivers and streams of the state to eliminate the black flies that are living under the rocks or clinging to the rocks at the bottom of the river while they wait to develop and emerge as adults the following year. So running water, actively running streams, is where will be where the black flies are reproducing.
All right, and they're not just out to get us. They're doing what they've got to do.
Well, they're doing what we all do, and that is they are perpetuating the species, and they just have this particular food source. We might add that we are not their only food source. They're also a problem, the blood feeding on other mammals, anything from small mammals to cows to deers to horses.
Well, and in fact, two of the eaglets in Decorah were forced out of their nest this spring, probably by buffalo gnats or those black flies.
Black flies, right.
So let's go now to Pam in Scott County. Hi, Pam.
Oh, hi. Thanks for taking my call. I am calling with a plant question about my poor forsythia that's well over 20 years old, has always leafed out in the spring, and the best I can remember, it's always bloomed. This spring, after the bad winter, it about a third of it leafed out, and it never bloomed at all.
Mm-hmm.
I had standing water in my backyard for a while, and so it had pretty wet feet for several weeks, and now that what had leafed out is looking dead. There's a few new puny spruces sprouts at the base, but do I just see if they'll come back, or do I just cut it off at ground level and plant something else? It looks pretty pitiful.
Yeah, I think I'd wait till the end of summer, and if it hasn't improved dramatically, I'd probably dig it up and plant something else next spring.
Okay.
Typically, that plant is very, very dependable, very easy to grow, but I'm assuming the extreme cold basically was the main culprit.
Okay. Okay. And then the wet feet was kind of like the last straw for this season.
Yeah, they can usually tolerate that pretty well. Now, if you want to plant another one next year, as far as a forsythia, make sure it's a hardy variety, like Meadowlark, for example, a very hardy variety. Also Northern Sun from Minnesota. So it's something very, very hardy.
Okay. And then would it be the same with my mock orange? It also had less leaf out, and it did bloom, but okay. It's now looking pretty pitiful from the wet feet, too, although okay. It was wetter footed than the forsythia.
Okay. Again, I'd probably evaluate it later on this summer, and again, if it's not looking good, remove it.
All right, Pam, thanks a lot for your call. Let's slip in an email question here. This one's from Mandy in Denver. Can I safely transplant a rhubarb plant this weekend?
You could if you had to, but if you can wait, I'd do it probably in mid-September.
All right, and here's one from Glenn. Our tomato plants are getting big. Would you advise cutting them back or just allow them to continue to grow?
Just allow them to grow.
All right, we will take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. It's Horticulture Day on Talk of Iowa. You can join us with your questions. Give us a call, 866-780-9100, 866-780-9100, or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. With me, Richard Giron, Iowa State University Extension Horticulture Specialist, and Donald Lewis, Professor of Entomology at Iowa State. This is Talk of Iowa. Iowa's rivers and streams are swollen with water right now. They're also teeming with insect life. Today, we'll find out about the insects living in those waters. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day. Iowa State University entomologist Donald Lewis will be here. Iowans have been encountering a lot of insects lately. This hour, we'll talk about aquatic insects, some we love to see and some we don't enjoy so much. Damselflies, dragonflies, mayflies, and more. Iowa State University Extension Horticulture Specialist Richard Giron will also be here, and he and Donald will answer your questions about plants and insects. Join the conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today. With me, Iowa State University Extension Horticulture Specialist Richard Giron and Donald Lewis, Professor of Entomology at Iowa State University. They are here to answer your questions. Give us a call, 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at Iowa Public Radio or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Next up, we've got Christine in Cedar Falls. Hi, Christine.
Good morning.
Hi, what's your question?
My question is, about a year ago I bought a piece of property that I believe at one point behind the garage was used for parking. The ground is about 50% dirt, 50% pea gravel. Very hard to dig in. I'd like to turn it into, you know, I'd love to grow milkweed and turn it into a butterfly area, maybe natural grass area. Is this possible, or is that just going to be poor ground forever?
You might try it. I would try, for example, butterfly weed, which is a native wildflower. It's a perennial. It's a very, very showy plant. It is fairly easy to grow. I would also maybe try some of the native grasses. Most of those can tolerate dry conditions. You might have to bring in additional topsoil to improve the growing conditions a little bit. So you can find a good source of either good topsoil or maybe compost, or you might bring in maybe 2 or 3 additional inches and work those into the soil. That might help.
Okay.
It's not going to be easy.
Right. Working them into the soil is pretty tricky. And she's not in a position where she'd want to use a tiller or something like that, would she, with all those rocks?
Probably not. Just probably using a shovel or spade as best they can.
Yeah. How about milkweed? Would that be a possibility? I'd love to make a butterfly, monarch butterfly area.
Well, the butterfly weed actually does attract the monarch.
Mm-hmm.
It's a much more attractive plant. You can buy it actually at garden centers. It typically has a bright orange flower. There are a few cultivars that have yellow flowers, but it's well-behaved. It's a nice clump-type plant, grows about 2 or 3 feet tall, very, very low maintenance, a very, very attractive plant.
He calls it butterfly weed. The rest of us call it butterfly milkweed.
Okay.
Thank you for your input.
Thanks a lot for your call, Christine. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. And Lisa's up next in Iowa City. Hi, Lisa.
Hi, thank you. So I live on the edge of town, and I have in a sort of semi-wooded area. I've learned to identify poison ivy, garlic, mustard, and oriental bittersweet, but I don't know what is in my yard is invasive and that I should try to pull or what I should try to keep. And I'd like to know if there's a place I can go to look at, search and identify for plants that they're good and some that are bad.
Well, there's a nice book, Wildflowers of Iowa Woodlands, that you may find at your public library on our bookstore. It's a very nice book written by authors from Iowa. And basically for each plant listed, these are native plants. The one page they have for the plant is a picture of the plant. And then the other page is basically a description of the plant, where it's typically found, some of the history of the plant. It's a very, very nice book. The other thing is all the plants in the book are listed not by their scientific name or common name, but by when they bloom. So in the front of the book, you have those things that bloom early in the spring, for example, bloodroot, Virginia bluebells, and then it simply goes through the summer. So it's kind of a nice book in that if you see something in the woods that's blooming, you can kind of figure out what it is possibly.
Well, garlic mustard blooms, and I know that I'm supposed to pull that, so...
Mm-hmm.
I'm just curious to know, so I really appreciate that. And can you repeat that again? I didn't write the title down.
Yeah, it's Wildflowers of Iowa Woodlands. Wildflowers of Iowa Woodlands.
All right. Lisa,
And we have lately been experimenting throughout Extension with an app on our phones or a website that is called iNaturalist. iNaturalist.org is the website. And it's an app that you can download, and apparently it has machine learning, artificial intelligence, that if you take a good, clear, cropped picture of your plant and upload it to that site, it will help you with the identification. At least it will give you some possibilities, saying, oh, maybe you've got one of these, and then you have to dig a little farther to find. But the iNaturalist app has been very useful for horticulturists and agronomists around the state of Iowa for identifying weeds, so maybe it will help you.
All right, Lisa, thanks a lot for your call. Next, let's go to Steve in Clear Lake. Hi, Steve. Steve, are you there?
Good morning.
Hi, what's your question?
I have two questions. We bought our house about 7 years ago, and I planted a garden, and in that was asparagus and strawberries, among other things. And during all of that time, we might have got one strawberry a year and one stalk of asparagus a year. Until this year, we've had enough asparagus for the two of us for 3 or 4 meals. And we've got strawberries blooming out of here. And it's wonderful. How do I get it to continue to do that?
Well, basically, as far as the asparagus, you should stop harvesting by now and just let it grow. Keep the weeds out as best you can, and then allow that foliage to remain through the summer. You can cut it back late in the fall, but we typically suggest doing it in late winter, early spring. And then you might fertilize early in the spring. That's basically it. As far as the strawberries, if they're June-bearing strawberries, typically what you need to do is, after they're done bearing fruit within the first week, go out with your lawnmower, actually, and mow off the foliage. Rake off the debris, get rid of it, and then take a spade or tiller and narrow the row down to an 8-inch wide strip. Fertilize lightly. The plant should start to leaf out and run again. And so by the end of summer, you should have a nice, healthy, 2-foot wide matted row of strawberry plants, which should be productive next spring.
All right, Steve, thanks so much for your call. Next up, let's go to Jeff in Amplington. Hi, Jeff.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure. What's your question?
I have iris around my house, mm-hmm. and I have a problem with Queen Anne's lace just taking over. And I'm wondering what would be the best way to try to clean this whole thing up.
Well, the best way typically would be by digging and pulling. Queen Anne's lace or wild carrot is a biennial plant. The first year it forms a little cluster of leaves near the ground. Then the second year it grows very rapidly, forms a flower stalk, flowers, produces seed, and then dies. So you want to control the seedlings in the fall. And the best way of doing that is by pulling and digging.
Okay, well, that's what I'll have to try to do.
Definitely don't let it go to seed.
Is there a good way to, like, pull the iris up and store them till I could get this kind of dug up and cleaned out?
Well, the nice thing is irises are pretty tough plants, and you can dig them up. I would put them in a tray or a bucket, and then maybe put them in the garage, maybe on the north side of the house, and they can probably stay there for a few weeks and then put them back. So they're pretty tough plants, pretty resilient. So you could do that, but it should be just a few weeks.
All right, Jeff, thanks a lot for your call. Here's a question from Constance. She says, I have a small nursery, that's in quotation marks, behind my garage that consists of numerous plants in pots, mostly hosta, which I have purchased during the planting seasons of the last 4 years or so and never got planted.
Okay.
They have survived through the ensuing winter and summer seasons amazingly. Part of their survival was due to the roots growing through the mm-hmm. bottom holes of the pots and establishing themselves in the ground. I wish to transplant them finally, but I worry about severing the grounded roots and the survival prospects of the plants. They're in good condition now.
I think late summer would be a good time, and you're going to have to basically lose some of the roots, but you're still going to have quite a few roots for each plant, so I would probably do it probably early September, mid-September. Very carefully dig them up. You're going to have to cut off some of the roots, knock them out of the pots, put them in the ground, and my guess is they'll be fine.
All right. They're clearly survivors.
Yep.
All right. Thanks a lot for that question. Here's one from Tim. I saw my first multiple group of lightning bugs last night in Pleasant Hill. I wonder if they've been affected by climate change.
Oh, maybe not climate change in a big way, but Richard and I were talking about lightning bugs before the show, that we've seen them now in Ames, and often you see the first lightning bugs in May. So I think they're a little late this year. I don't think they're going to change dramatically in a huge way, but this year they do feel late, but they're eventually going to get here, and we hope the weather cooperates so that they can get out and give those good shows. I think of the 4th of July as sort of the peak time for lightning bug viewing, but it can run from the end of May to the end of August in most years. Will that shift with dramatic climate change? Sure, they could move a little differently. But lightning bug larvae live in damp locations where they feed on small insects and snail and slug eggs and so forth. And drought is the worst thing for lightning bug development. So getting lots of rainfall as a consequence of climate change may actually help our lightning bugs more than the droughts did back in the 70s and 80s.
All right. Susan is on the line next from Windsor Heights. Hi, Susan.
Good morning. We had an influx of bugs in our house this spring, which a friend told me were called stink bugs. We've been taking them out, relocating them outside. But on a recent trip returning from Minneapolis and stopping at a rest stop, we saw posters on the bulletin board that the state of Minnesota was warning people that these bugs could be injurious to crops. We have not seen similar notations in Iowa. The bugs in our house appear to be the same as the photographs on the posters at the rest stop in Minnesota. Is this something we need to be concerned about, number one? Number two, how did they get in our house, and how do we get rid of them?
The brown marmorated stink bug is a new species that we've only had in the state of Iowa since about 2010. It is about 5/8 of an inch long, and it has a very definite shield shape. It is broadest at the shoulders, but then it gradually and tapers off to the tail end. Brown marmorated stink bug behaves in September and October the same way a box elder bug does. So they get into your house the same way box elder bugs do. They land on the south side of your house on a sunny day in September. They climb into the siding when the sun goes down. They climb through gaps around windows or eaves or soffits, wherever they can get in. And then they hide out in your house and would hibernate if it stayed cold. But if it warms up from the furnace or from the sunshine, they remain active. So it's an accidental invader in the house, just like box elder bugs and multicolored Asian lady beetles have been for a while. Yes, brown marmorated stink bug feeds on crops, but so far in Iowa and here in the Midwest, we have not seen stink bugs as a severe pest of crops. It's still a household nuisance, but certainly back east, where the brown marmorated stink bug has been present since the late 90s, they do see damage to apples and tomatoes and peppers and others. So we are watching for that. We just haven't seen it yet here in the state of Iowa.
All right. So how about her house? What does she do about them?
You know, pick them up and send them back outside is a great thing to do. If you had too many of them to do that, you could suck them up with the vacuum cleaner. But they're called stink bugs for a reason. And I haven't noticed the smell when I find one in my house and carry it back outside. But apparently in Virginia, where my daughter lived for a while, they would suck them up in the vacuum cleaner, and that would make the house stink because the bugs have been disturbed. So be careful what you do with them if you have a lot of them. But in 3 years, I'm up to 5 that I have found in my house and taken back outside.
Huh. Lucky guy.
Lucky guy.
All right. Here's a question. This is not about an insect, Donald, but since we've talked about them on the show before, I'm going to ask you anyway. This is from Tim. Can you talk about jumping worms? Have they displaced traditional earthworms in a lot of areas?
Jumping worm will eventually displace earthworms, the typical night crawlers or the typical garden worms that we have. But jumping worm is now present in, has been documented in 7 counties in the state of Iowa. It's over in Dubuque and Muscatine, and most recently we added Buchanan County. It's also been found in Linn County, and it was found here at the Iowa State University campus. So jumping worm is a different kind of invasive worm. For those of us in the upper half of Iowa, all of our earthworms are invasive. None of them are native. They were all introduced over the last 10,000 years. But this jumping worm behaves like an agitated snake. It wriggles and it jumps and it squirms and they crawl up out of the container. You lift up the mulch and they just go wild with their wiggling behavior. Because they reproduce so fast, because they eat so much, they will displace the other earthworms that are already here, and they eat so much they eliminate the organic matter on the trees. So look up Wisconsin jumping worm and you'll find a lot of good information about how it is impacting the sloped woodlands of Wisconsin. I don't think it's going to be a severe landscape problem for us, but it is something to reckon with.
All right, let's try to slip in one more question. This is Ryan from Des Moines. Ryan, what's your question, quickly?
Hi, we have an elm tree that we planted. It's about 8 feet tall, and the leader at the very top was only about 3/8 inch thick, broke off. There are branches coming off of the leader. I was wondering if it's going to suffer, or if one of those are going to take place of the leader.
My guess would be one or two of those will grow more upright, and if it does, great. But if you have more than one, I would basically keep the best one and prune out any others that may act like a leader.
All right. Ryan, thank you so much for your call, and we are out of time. Richard Giron, thank you.
You're welcome.
Iowa State University Extension horticulture specialist Richard Giron and Donald Lewis, thank you very much.
Thank you, Charity. It's always a pleasure.
Donald Lewis, a professor of entomology at Iowa State University. We will be back with Horticulture Day again next Friday. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio. You never have to miss a show. Please subscribe to our podcast. Just search for Talk of Iowa wherever you get your podcasts. The show is produced by Rick Brewer, Caitlin Harrop, and Dennis Reese. We had production assistance today from Camus Leeson and technical support from Nick Brinks. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbie.